Blog Talk Radio.
Good day, everybody. This is Rabbi Rich Lazarus, your host for today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows, as we have been mentioning, are a desire to explore a variety of issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. We invite you to share comments and suggestions with us at rabbi@jewishsacredaging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page, which we really appreciate if you can connect with us on that and give us some ideas. We hope to welcome, through the magic of technology, Dr. David Laskin, geriatrician, medical director, hospice medical director here in New Jersey. Dr. Laskin, are you there?
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Hey, good to hear your voice. Fellow Phillies fan, and we won't discuss baseball yet. Anyway, nice to have you with us again. Dr. Laskin has been with us a variety of times on different podcasts, and it's been a while, and we wanted to bring him back because there's increasing amounts of things to talk about in baby boomer health. There's lots of questions to ask you. I just want to jump in one thing, and I alluded to this, and we've talked a little bit about this in the past, about this thing called telemedicine. David, the idea of what's your take on this? You know, the apps on the iPhones that allow you to enter everything medically, physicians doing there's a commercial on television, you know, I forget which one, it's a sick kid, and they bring in the laptop, and there's the kindly doctor on the laptop doing doing the consult. What's your is this the way of the future?
Well, it's a great question. Certainly, as you've learned personally, and obviously many of the listeners have, that technology in medicine is just absolutely insane. That the advances are just burgeoning, and telemedicine is the next coming. So have I had any personal involvement in telemedicine? No. But I will tell you that 70% of diagnoses come from history taking. So by having a detailed history, whether it's person to person or by telemedicine, you're going to get a lot of the necessary information in order to help the person that's having the symptoms. You know, I'm old school. I like hands-on medicine. The apps on the iPhone I have not used yet. There's thousands of them. But I do believe this is going to be a wave of the future.
Wow, that's you know, I'm fascinated by it. And I keep seeing the apps on phones. And I keep reading about the increase in electronic, especially for our generation, you know, heart monitors, glucose monitors, all kinds of things. I guess it's part of the whole health revolution.
Well, sure, and the other thing is being proactive about your health is part of the formula. It's going to help you live longer and have a better quality of life.
So, which brings me, you know, you deal a lot with boomers, and it's one of your specialties. If you could, like, draw up the three greatest challenges to baby boomers in our health-wise, what would they be?
Well, I'm glad you put that, because I believe for all baby boomers, there's three pillars that we need to be cognizant of. And I'm sure you've talked about that many times in your shows. One, of course, is financial stability. Physical health is obviously crucial. And the other thing is something called subjective well-being, your happiness, your social connectiveness, your sense of purpose, your contentment, your satisfaction, etc. But in terms of physical health, I've always told people the way that we are going to have a quality of life going forward, we have to have the right genetics, i.e. be lucky. We have to be proactive about our symptomatology, and we have to work hard at staying healthy. And that's going to mean understanding what the pitfalls are as we age. And we all have, unfortunately, lost people or are watching people fight incredible battles of heart disease, cancer, strokes, lung disease, accidents, including falls, and dementia. And what do we do going forward, being proactive about those things?
So how, you know, the TV is filled with ads. The proactive stuff, my sense is that there's a real health revolution amongst boomers who, I think, you know, on a psycho-spiritual level are more cognizant, aware that you know, death is, we're all mortal. But how do, you know, the proactive way, what's the best way? I mean, one, I'm sure you've probably seen them in your practices, one could become a slave to being proactive, you know, take every test known to man, and, you know, but what's the best way to do this? What's the best way to create that healthy lifestyle?
Right. We've all worked so hard in our working lives. We've all worked so hard in raising families. And now we want to be able to enjoy the fruits of our labor for the next 20 or 30 years, whatever time is left for us. We want to do it with high quality. So, as I mentioned, all of the myriad things that affect us as we age, looking at heart disease, obviously smoking is an incredible risk, and hopefully most of us are not smoking at all. But it's also about monitoring blood pressure, and new guidelines have come out about blood pressures being less than 130 over 70 is the goal. So that's going to mean more cost to take more medicines to get that blood pressure down, more compliance issues, and more side effect issues in order to get blood pressure below 130 over 70. We have to treat, or we have to be aware of diabetes, which is unfortunately a high risk factor for heart disease. We have to be aware of cholesterol. We all have learned about the HDL and the LDL and the use of statins and all those things that are mandatory in combating the risk of cholesterol and heart disease. We also know about sedentary lifestyle increases your cardiovascular mortality and morbidity. So therefore, we need to be very active about our exercise. And we also know now about the risk of dental plaque, how that is tied in with the potential for arterial plaque. So there's lots of things just in looking at that aspect of being proactive in cardiovascular disease.
Well, when you say dental plaque, that's a new one on me. When you go to the dentist and they clean off the tartar or stuff, so there's a relationship between the amount of dental plaque you have.
That is correct. If you have an overabundance of dental plaque and you're not taking care of it, studies have shown that you are increasing the chances for increased arterial plaque.
Cool. I didn't know that. I mean, obviously, I didn't know. It's not a course in rabbinic school. spiritual plaque, maybe, but certainly not. So, you know, it's amazing that you mentioned that, only because we've had dentists and eye doctors on these podcasts, and, you know, a couple of years ago, and they all indicate that they can do these when they do their examination, they can tell if there's something else going on in the body by the examination of the teeth, the tongue, the eyes. So Jewishly, it's fascinating, only because, you know, there's a strand that we talk about that everything is the mind-body-soul connection, interrelated, this holistic approach. But what you're really saying is it is all interrelated, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Wow. One of the things, there's been a couple of articles recently, in fact, I think in a recent New York Times op-ed piece, it may have been this week, the idea of sugar. Could you just talk a little about this growing trend now to get rid of sugars? And are there any good sugars? You know, if you walk into Dunkin' Donuts and get the medium coffee,
the right place to walk,
and with a couple of sugars, is that going to kill me?
So, sugar is something called a carbohydrate, and we've heard of simple carbohydrates, or the simple sugars, and complex carbohydrates. So the complex carbohydrates are your vegetables, your fruits, the things that are high in fiber, those are very, very beneficial. The simple sugars, like cake, candies, cookies, sugared beverages, table sugar, etc., can increase chances for hyperglycemia, diabetic issues. And the biggest risk with diabetes is, number one, your genetic risk factors from your parents, and also obesity. So if you have an obese person that had parents who are diabetic and they're not following a good diet, they're in trouble.
So, and but they're good sugars, right?
I mean, an apple, good sugar, sure.
I need an apple that has sugar in it, but that's a good sugar?
That's correct. That's a complex carbohydrate. That takes a lot of metabolism to break down to be able to... Remember, sugar is the fuel for our cells. It's a fuel for our brain. It's an important, necessary ingredient in our nutrition. But there are certain sugars that are taboo and certain sugars that are very beneficial.
And so when we see these ads on TV or popular press articles about the difference between white sugar, brown sugar, refined sugar, is one better than the other, or just...
I mean, you can go crazy doing that, sure.
Yeah, I know.
But obviously there are natural sweeteners like honey, lemon, etc., that help to improve the taste of things. But if you can avoid table sugar, brown sugar completely, that'd be an ideal start.
Wow. You know, it's a lot. And people say, I'm sure you've seen people say, doctor, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, and I don't want to give up. You know, I love ice cream. And what's the situation? Because, you know, Maimonides in the 12th century preached a medical philosophy of moderation. He said, don't go overboard in one way or the other, but the golden mean, he called it. Live a life of moderation. Is that a good piece of advice to bring forward to the 21st century and how we take care of our health?
I think it's a very good statute to think about, moderation. And again, set your priorities. I think, like I said, most of us worked very, very hard through our lives, and what we would like would be a quality of life, to be able to enjoy our retirement years, to our grandchildren, enjoy healthy activities, travel, etc. And you need your health. You know, how do, as we age, stay as healthy as possible? And that's what we all want.
You talked about one of those three pillars for baby boomers, financial stability.
I think
it's called.
Mm-hmm.
How important, in your experience, is the impact of economics on health?
Oh, it's astounding. I mean, obviously, there have been a lot of cases where people have come into the office saying, you know, I didn't get the prescription filled because it was too expensive. And, you know, you obviously have some empathy about that, but the bottom line is you're trying to do what's best for your patients, to get the best technology, the best medication, to be able to have the best quality of life. And so... financial impact. I mean, I'm sure there's been topics on your radio show about the fact that a lot of seniors do not have the wherewithal in their retirement portfolios to be able to afford more expensive medication, and it's scary.
Yeah, I mean, can you just talk? I mean, there's been also, again, in recent years, this explosion of articles and conversations about the cost of medication. How does a family who doesn't have that economic stability and needs medication? What are not everybody who may listen to this may be of that economic level to not have to worry about this, but there's millions and millions of people. And I'm sure you've seen it in your practice and
Absolutely. In
your hospice. How do people begin to cope with the fact that I need that cancer medication? And I don't want to be put in a position, unless this is really hyperbole, of having to make a choice between that medication, paying the rent, or putting food on the table.
Well, you bring up a very, very big Achilles heel. As a physician, you're tuned into this kind of stuff because you don't want to break the bank. You want to do what's best for your patient to be able to give them the best chance at treating something or recovering from something or curing something. And this is a discussion. This is why I think it's important to have a relationship with your physician to be able to talk about these issues openly and not be avoiding the need for life essential medication. So, obviously generics have been rising, and they've been very beneficial to cut the costs. But these special cancer medications, which obviously are making a fortune now with the television ads, you see the ad for non-small cell carcinoma. They have like 18 different medicines available now. Those are very expensive. So having a discussion with your physician about what's the best thing for me is the first start, how to combat the costs.
Do you recommend that you know, we talk a lot about nowadays with boomers having the conversation with their family about end of life and having a conversation with a financial planner about looking 10, 20 years down the road? Do people come into physicians and say, I'm relatively healthy, I want to enjoy the rest of my life? We need to mark out a what-if, a plan, a medical plan, things that I should be starting to do long-term, or do people more and more just do it on a case-by-case or wait till the last minute?
Well said. So in New Jersey, there are two things that I abide by. First off, most people in my practice are over the age of 50, so I have the discussion within the first couple of visits about something called a living will, where someone talks about these are the things I do or do not want if a physician tells me that I have less than 6 months to live. And that includes intubation, intravenous medications, hospitalization, CPR, etc. Recently, within the last 10 or 15 years, there's a rise in America of something called the POLST form, P-O-L-S-T. I don't know if you have shows about that, but it's a practitioner's order for life-sustaining therapy. And the POLST form, in my practice, comes into effect when there's been a dramatic change in someone's health. So, for example, Mrs. Jones has been coming to the office for many, many years and has a devastating stroke. At that time, a POLST form is something necessary because that is a direct order from a physician in talking with the patient and family about what your goals are, what your wishes are, and how would you like the next couple of months to progress in terms of what-ifs in medical care. And understanding someone's goals and wishes is paramount. And again, that's, again, stressing a relationship with your doctor.
And that's,
but I go into an urgent care center, that won't happen.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's another question, too. This explosion of, pop-up medical centers, urgent care centers, is it revolutionizing medicine and the delivery of health care? And how does that work is it better? Is it for people who, more and more people who just don't have a family doctor or don't have access to one? This is a revolution that's permanent. This is not going to go away, right? Because it just seems to be a huge amount of money being invested in these things.
Right. So,
and how is it changing medical care?
So, as you've learned over the years, that first of all, there are 800,000 physicians in America. In the next 7 years, 40%, that's 40%, of those physicians will be retiring.
Wow.
That's 320,000 physicians in all different fields. And one of the fields that's not being replenished is that of primary care medicine. Your pediatricians, your obstetricians, your family doctors, and your internists, because of the fact that they are at the lower level of the hierarchy of physicians. That if you have a big debt coming out of medical school, you're going to want a subspecialty to make a good living. And so therefore, if you're not replenishing the primary care doctors, that need needs to be filled some other way. And that's why you have these minute clinics at the CVS, and that's why you have urgent care centers. So it's fulfilling a need because there's less and less doctors available. The waiting lines are longer in emergency rooms, but it's also a financial boon for the people that are putting up the urgent care centers because they're very busy.
Yeah, I imagine they are. I mean, and I do know people who that's sometimes their first wave of offense or defense that they'll, they go to at 10 o'clock at night, they go to instead of the emergency room, they go to the urgent care center down the street as opposed to the hospital 6-10 miles away.
No one's getting to know their history. No one's getting to know their story. And I'm sure you've preached that a million times. Know someone's story. What are they all about? What are their goals and wishes? And that's something you have to develop with a relationship.
Yeah, well, it goes back to the very first thing you said about you learn everything from detailed histories.
Correct.
And if you just look at the knee or the elbow without understanding what's behind it, but again, that takes time, and I guess time is money, and time is one of these things that we've had this conversation a little bit that has driven a lot of physicians out of the practice of medicine, that they don't have the time to spend with patients that they wanted to.
Well said.
Statins. The last time we talked on the air, and this is I think about a year ago, maybe 8 months ago, there was a whole new report about statins and the fact that the need for it has changed, the ceiling or the floor when you need it has changed. Could you just talk a little about where people are with statins and this
sure.
one report that I remember seeing recently that if you're over a certain age, they're really not even that effective. Is that true?
Well, again, technology and comments are very abundant. The study that came out in 2013 basically said, look, we know that cholesterol is one of the six risk factors for heart disease, and we now have a template of who should get statins. And there are four groups, in my estimation, that should be getting a statin. One, smokers. Number two, people that have had strokes or heart attacks. Three, people that have LDL cholesterol greater than 190, with normal being less than 130. And number four, diabetics. And those are your four groups. And I've gone by that adage in my practice. I think that those are the people that have to understand why I'm prescribing a statin, which can be a very expensive medication, which can have a ton of side effects. But in terms of understanding risks versus benefits and meeting your goals and wishes, that I don't want to die of a heart attack, I don't want to be impaired by a stroke, that this is something that needs to be treated.
You've been a big proponent if I'm not mistaken, talking to people, baby boomers, and people who are our parents' generation about the challenge of falls and how to fall-proof a home, a domicile, an apartment. Could you just speak to that again? Because you keep hearing over and over again in conversations, yes, my mom fell and broke her hip and she was never the same. Or how challenging, important is it for people to be aware of their environment and falling?
Well, like I started the show, that accidents, falls, are the fifth leading cause of death in the United States. And who's going to fall? Older people. And if you've fallen once, you're going to fall again. And why is that happening? Is it because of dementia? Because you have something called gait apraxia, A-P-R-A-X-I-A, which is where you basically forget how to coordinate yourself? Is it because you're on a blood pressure medication that's too strong for you, and every time you stand up, you fall right over because your blood pressure drops? Is it because you're on a diuretic, because you are dehydrated, not replenishing the fluids that you should be getting? Is it because of the fact that your eyesight is going bad? Is it because of the fact that you don't have coordination and strength in your legs anymore, so you're tripping over the lip of the door when you come in your house? So understanding why the fall happened is crucial. And again, that's establishing relationship with a physician to understand all about your house and talking with the family, etc. But it's also about stressing strength, coordination, and flexibility. And that ties into exercise.
Well, that's talk a little bit about that, because you know, I've become a devotee of at least getting down to the gym three or four.
You're a gym rat.
No, hardly. But there's this governmental standard and of 150 minutes a week of at least moderate exercise. Do you hold to that, or you know?
Absolutely.
Just, yeah.
So in 2008, the surgeon.
Go ahead.
In 2008, the U.S. Surgeon General came out with a statement about what should be ideal exercise for us on a weekly basis, and that is 150 minutes per week. And that's either in 5 30-minute segments or 3 50-minute segments. And it should be a combination of two different types of exercise. One is called resistance training, which we know about as weight, calisthenics, stretching, yoga, and Pilates. And then also our cardiac exercises, the aerobic exercises, which include treadmill, swimming, use the elliptical machine, cycling, fast walking. And all those things are paramount in helping us fight off the risk of falls.
But it's also good, isn't it, for just the regular keeping your breath? I've seen some studies that exercise, regular exercise for boomers and older adults, improves blood flow to the brain and can be a contributor to delaying or prohibiting dementia or Alzheimer's. I don't know whether that's true.
It is true.
It makes sense that it does. Yeah, it does. And, I mean, it's just, and you feel better and you look better, I guess. And it's important to understand that for people who may have some mobility issues, there are exercises they can do. I've seen it in gyms, chair exercises, water aerobics.
Sure.
It's just the idea of keeping the body moving, which is, by the way, Maimonidean from the 12th century.
And also, on top of your work, again, the four big things to think about: spiritual, psychological, emotional, physical. All those things are improved with exercise.
You work, and you're a medical director of hospice.
That's
a hospice,
right.
in New Jersey. The name of the hospice is what?
Ascend, A-S-C-E-N-D.
Do you still find a reluctance on the part of people to understand what that word hospice means?
Absolutely. The H word is a dirty word. People think hospice means that they're going to kill me.
Yeah.
And studies have now shown that, first of all, hospice is about improving quality of life in someone who has a life-threatening disease that could kill them within the next 6 months. But studies have also shown that people actually live longer being cared for in hospice rather than going in and out of the hospital like a revolving door.
How do you work with people? Because this every clergy person, doctor, mental health professional has had conversations about loss, and people come into your office or you worked with, and not only in a hospice situation, but you know, I can't walk as well as I used to. I can't see as well as I used to. I am now in a wheelchair. How do you begin to, in your profession, in your practice, deal with a lot of what is the normal losses that accompany longevity?
Okay. So I begin the discussion by telling people about the difference between curative and palliative medicine. That when we're younger, we strive for curative medicine. We will go through any kind of surgery, procedure, medication, cost to be able to extend our lives. Because, you know, we're 40 years old, we want to live to be 90 years old, and therefore we'll go through those things. But as we get older, and as we are plagued by different things, whether it's disabling arthritis or end-stage lung disease or a debilitating cancer or a stroke, then our wishes and our goals are not to be able to, we know that we can't be cured anymore from these things, but we'd like to have a better quality of life every day. And I keep stressing that mantra, quality of life. But that's what it's all about. We love to have a good day every day if we can do it. And understanding palliative medicine means that our focus is going to be on reducing pain, reducing shortness of breath, reducing constipation, reducing nausea, reducing fatigue. And those are the things that we're going to strive for. Unfortunately, people that have a diagnosis where they're going to die within a six-month time, whether it's from Lou Gehrig's disease or cancer or an end-stage heart disease, that's where hospice comes in.
There's a favorite phrase of many people, that attitude is everything. In your practice, from all your years of experience up now through your medical directorship in Ascend Hospice, how important is a person's attitude towards all this health, end of life, disease, loss?
It's crucial. Again, when you think about the causes of pain, and you and your 50 years of experience have lived this every day, understanding the physical pain, the psychological pain, the emotional pain, the spiritual pain.
Yeah.
Attitude is crucial.
And have you seen people change their attitude in the process of treatment? I mean, and really come in, let's say, this is the end, and through the process of therapy or treatment or medications, emerge in a different way, or how they approach dealing with a disease or a chronic condition?
Absolutely.
We have just a couple minutes left, Dr. Laskin, and we're both living in New Jersey. There's a new governor. There's a new attempt on the part of a variety of people to pass legislation to join the 7 states and district about choice in dying legislation. Do you have an opinion on this, about this legislation? Because it just went through one of the committees in the House this past week, on Monday, March 12th, and probably is going to start working its way through the state legislature, and there are 5 or 6 other states that have legalized choice in dying. Do you see this as something that you can support?
That's a great question. You've had a lot of very good questions today. I just recently had a case in the hospice where a gentleman, 59 years of age, had a debilitating car accident 10 years ago and fractured his 5th cervical vertebra, leaving him quadriplegic and dependent upon a ventilator. And so he was institutionalized and has lived like this for the last 10 years, supported by a very, very loving mother in her late 80s who recently passed away. And he said, now that she's gone, there's no one there for me. I'm ready to die. And so as a hospice director, I was tasked with the decision, do I just take this person off a ventilator and watch them essentially suffocate, or is there some other process that can be done? And what was decided was that there, when people are on ventilators, you do a weaning process, that they make the choice to remove themselves from the ventilator. They have to be psychologically cleared by a psychologist, and they go through a period where the ventilator settings are turned down, and eventually it's stopped, and the families around them, and so whatever period of time is left for them to go in peace with the use of morphine, etc. So I'm not advocating physician-assisted suicide at the moment. I'm sure that that's going to be a challenge for the next generation of physicians, but I think that's something that's going to be coming.
Dr. David Laskin, geriatrician, medical director of Ascend Hospice in New Jersey. Thank you very much for lots of great information. Continued success. Good luck. Thank you. Thank you again for your time and your expertise and your caring. Continue. Good luck. And say hello to the family for me.
And so very kind of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being a part of today's broadcast on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows will be archived as podcasts on JewishSacredAging.com, and all of our shows are archived on there. Again, we thank you for listening. We thank Lubetkin Media and our producer, Steve Lubetkin. To all of you, take care. Have a great week, and we'll see you on the next broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Again, check out those podcasts on JewishSacredAging.com. To all of you, take care. Thank you for listening. Be well and stay healthy.